Committee. Good afternoon, colleagues, and welcome to those of you in the audience. We appreciate your being here. We're going to start the meeting with a work session, and we're dealing with LC 2047. With that, we'll open the work session. Committee, our thought is that we would make this bill, this LC rather, a committee bill. If you're interested in supporting it, it does not mean that you are saying that you will vote for the bill later on. It simply means that you're willing to support it as a committee bill. With that in mind, does anyone have any questions? Yes, Representative Hobson.
Mr. Chair, I move LC Draft 2047 be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Hobson moves LC Draft 2047 be introduced as a committee bill. Formal discussion. Okay, well, hearing none then, the bill will be introduced as a committee bill. Very good. We're looking forward to today's meeting. We're very interested on this committee of really examining the overall Oregon assessment system, the SIM, the CAM, working in the portfolio, and we are going to be hearing from a lot of people. And we're going to take our time. We want to be very thorough. We want to be very detailed. And with that in mind, we're going to begin today's committee meeting with invited testimony on the SIM and the CAM. We have a number of people who have been invited, and others could certainly testify. But we will begin with Robert Saunders from Eugene. Actually, Bob, I should say, but...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Farr.
If you would prefer to come up together, would that be okay, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I would like to introduce a personal friend, professional colleague. This is Mr. Jim Jameson, the principal of Willamette High School down in the Eugene area. Again, I am Robert Saunders. I am one of the core team educators at the newest of the alternative programs in the Eugene area, Kalapuya High School. Prior to beginning my new high school, I was working as a colleague and as a teacher for Mr. Jameson at Willamette High School for 10 years. We were one of the six original sites chosen to find definitions, working truths around the 21st Century Schools Act and what it would mean for kids and how we would make it workable as an institution. We began that process in 1991. I came on board in 1992, and we were very active in bringing forth both the SIM programs and all six of the CAMs at Willamette High School. Jim, do you want to...
Thank you very much, Backlund. Nice to see you again, and Representative Hobson.
Thank you.
Wanted to take a few minutes just to explain how things work on the Willamette High School end of certificates of mastery. We're huge proponents of certificates of mastery. We think they work very well for kids under most circumstances. We agree with the purpose of the original law, best educated workforce in America, and the equal to any in the world. We think that's achievable in Oregon if a number of things fall in place. It's good for kids for a lot of reasons. You know, when you and I were in school, you know, the measure of academic achievement was the diploma. That's not high enough. We believe that a certificate of mastery is a positive challenge for many kids. And the certificate of advanced mastery at Willamette inspires hundreds of our kids to achieve beyond what they think they can, and to find a meaningful adult place for themselves in the adult world. The way kids progress through these two certificates at Willamette allows them to get some regular and intensive help from adults. We call them their portfolio manager. And they, students 9th and 10th grade, meet with the portfolio manager 6 to 8 times a year to examine their progress towards meeting the standards, both in terms of their test scores, but also the in-depth classroom assignments that are the other side of earning a CIM. There are some things that bother us about certificates of mastery, just in terms of our being educators. Sometimes it's overly complex for kids and families to understand. And some of the complexities make it difficult for people to appreciate the system with the positive attitude we've left. Second, some kids are not motivated to achieve a CIM. Some of them see no value added for themselves. And it's a big problem for a number of kids. Some will achieve it because it's there, and they just like achieving a higher standard. But for many kids, they begin to realize that outside the high school world, it may not have value for them. Third difficulty we've had is from the school side are the frequent policy changes that have come from this fair city. Starting in 1995 with the revision of the original 1991 law, second example I would give you are the persistent delay in social studies standards. And a number of schools have done a variety of things internally in their system to prepare for social studies implementation. And then there is a retreating from an implementation date, and schools are left with things in place that don't match up with current standards for kids. Third example I would give you would be the difficulty with the past proficiencies, and that may be a whole other discussion, but there was a tie between the CIM standards and the past proficiencies for college entrance with the Oregon University system, and that system is, I will say, in disarray, at least from high school principals' point of view, after we have made a number of statements to parents and kids about how things will work, we find they won't work that way after all. And it's led a lot of folks to believe that, frankly, if they do nothing, the system will change yet again with another 2 or 3 years implementation date. So policy changes have been very difficult for schools to deal with. And finally, I would say that many at the high school level, at least, are very pleased to see the progress of the quality ed model and how it seems to be offering a way to look at the relationship between systems and resources for systems and success of students in that system. And I've had the opportunity to be with the original QEM that Speaker Lundquist began in the late 90s, and I'm a strong believer in the quality ed model as a path for us. I would maybe offer to the committee a sample of our CIM recognition program, if I could give that.
Mm-hmm. Please. Mm-hmm.
We have been strong believers in the CIM and have chosen to make a big deal out of it at Willamette High School and to honor those students and families who have earned a CIM. We do similar recognition ceremonies for the Certificate of Advanced Mastery. And this, our fourth recognition night, the number of students who earned a CIM has approximately doubled from our first recognition night. I think we'd be happy to entertain any questions or participate in any dialogue that the committee would have.
Thank you. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you too. In regard to the CIM, and I think your second one there, that some kids don't see the value, in response to that, are you recommending or suggesting or even thinking of that it would be better to have it optional as a special tribute to those who do see the value and do shoot for that achievement?
Well, in effect, it is optional, Representative, because if students choose not to participate, they don't have to participate. We've tried to make it a part of our system. Of course, all students take the tests in 10th grade. And the classroom assignments that are the other piece of earning a CIM are also graded. And they're graded on a state scoring guide for CIM attainment, but they're also graded as part of the regular classroom work for students. And so students who say, oh, I'm not interested in the CIM, they do the assignments because it goes in the teacher's grade book. So what I think our sense is that we would like to see, I'm going to say the broader society, place a value on this high achievement for students. If we as a society believe it's important for as many students as possible to achieve that highly, then various means should be found, and I don't mean they all need to be legislated, but the broader society needs to honor that for students.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't agree with you more, Jim, and I guess my question, and I'm sure you have given thought to this, how do we get the broader society to see the value and the undergirding of importance that goes with it?
Representative Hobson, if I can address that. Prior to being an educator, I was a professional soldier, then I was a clinician, and then I was with two Fortune 500 companies. I came into education late. There has to be a carrot, there has to be a stick for most of these processes if we're going to use the word standard. Something that happens if you don't reach it, and something that happens if you do. Something to get students at all levels to strive to improve. One of the easiest things we could do is we could ask private businesses, Oregon State employment page, that on applications give note to, do you have a SIM, do you have a CAM, as opposed to what's the highest level of achievement you have obtained. Something as similar as for a veteran, you receive points, employment points, something that these kids could see, I'm being recognized for going beyond that which I could have chosen to achieve that would have been a lot easier, which is the regular high school diploma.
Representative Dalto.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a statement was made that the CAM allows students to accomplish more than they think they can, at least in Willamette. I guess I'm not understanding why we need a mechanism for accountability to get students to achieve. I mean, your teachers are obviously enabling their students to be successful and giving them the tools that they need. I don't know why we need an accountability tool, why that makes folks successful, which is, I think, kind of what you were saying, or maybe I misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the question, Representative. The intent of my remark about the Certificate of Advanced Master is that it allows students to see how their academic learning applies in the adult world. That's a huge desire for 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds. There are many of them ready to enter the adult world before we think they're ready to enter. And it allows them to do certain things, see how their academic learning can apply on a business site or community service site of some kind. It allows them to have internships, sometimes paid, sometimes not, where they can provide something of use to others, step out of the academic environment and do something in that world. And it often allows them to, I'll say, test their beliefs about who they are as a person. It allows them to try something in the adult world and perhaps find out, no, that's not what I thought it was. And we think it's better for kids to do these kinds of things at 16, 17, and 18 than when they're in college or at age 22 or 23. So I see it not as an accountability system so much, but as a system to get kids who are ready into the adult world and performing some adult tasks and do things that bring value to their lives and to the lives of others.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Can't they do everything you just described without a CAM?
They could indeed. But in the traditional system of simply the diploma system, it was not required nor encouraged. And the Certificate of Advanced Mastery system not only encourages it, but requires kids and students to be able to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Farr.
Thank you. Well, we have spoken a little bit about how it applies to businesses. I'm understanding that the people in the business community don't really... What I'm gathering from people is that the people in the business community don't really have an understanding of what the SIM is or how it might apply to their business. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's probably true.
That's a very fair assessment.
And go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, not only do the business leaders not know what the SIM is about, they may be hearing three or four different definitions of it depending on who they're speaking to. So even the explanations of the concepts change, show variability, and we have questions from the end product, the business leaders who will hire these people, to people within education. What is this really all about? And until we can at least define our terms and set a direction that all are following, it's very difficult to describe what our intent is.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume, since it's called a certificate, that when the kids graduate, they actually get a piece of paper that says Certificate of Initial Mastery. What else does it say on the certificate?
It lists language from the Oregon Standards and Board State Board policy that describes, in terms of reading, writing, math, and science, something about the standards that they have shown they can perform.
Is it, as a business person, if I had one of your graduates sitting across from me and they handed me the certificate, would it? Do you believe that what it says on the certificate is something that would make me go, oh, wow, this is good? Or is it something that's a little bit like, doesn't mean anything to me?
Sorry that I had not brought a certificate with me to show you. It's probably too short to accomplish what you just suggested, Representative Barr. But I believe that it shows more than any current document or any other document in the traditional system. I have yet to talk to a Willamette alum who has said he or she had to show a high school transcript and had questions about the high school transcript when applying for a job.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative. Oh, sorry, I'll get back to you. Representative Bakken.
Thank you. Part of the difficulty I'm having with this part of the analysis, let me explain it to you, and then if you could develop it a little further for me. It seems to me that a high school graduate applying for jobs is not going to be applying for jobs in which there is the opportunity for some type of phenomenal growth or opportunity in that job that the certificate would really make much of a difference in. That seems to happen after your college career is done. And when you're applying for more professional types of jobs. And it would seem to me that the value of the SimCam after you've completed 2 or 4 years of college doesn't seem to me there would be any great value in it in applying for jobs at that point. So I'm seeing a disconnect in the entering of the workforce to the value of the SimCam. And maybe you could develop that a little bit further for me. Do you understand what I said?
I do understand what you said, Representative, and I, to a point, agree to it also. Once you go beyond high school and have received an associate's degree or a baccalaureate degree, people tend to look at those higher degrees. Depending on where you are in Oregon, you will have a tremendous difference in what percentage of high school graduates choose to go on to college-level courses. Many do step out into the workplace for jobs that are similar to the jobs that their father might have had or their grandfather might have had. In Eastern Oregon, there might be still towns in which jobs are somewhat limited and quite traditional. And that's not in any way pointing that they are less than equal to any jobs in the other areas. It's just a fact of the wide diversity that makes up Oregon. For those kids, the CIM and the CAM may be things that they can take a great deal of personal pride in as they enter the workforce, and later on in life they may choose to return to the college level courses or technically skilled courses.
Yes, I would offer a couple of comments, Representative. Not all students go to college, certainly, and they enter a variety of other fields of endeavor. Some never go back to college. Some go back to college at points in their lives. And my thought is that those students who enter the workforce with no additional education after 12th grade, they do things for us in our lives. They perform services for us in a wide variety of occupational settings. My hope is that they're the best educated people they can be. and that they have achieved a very high level of success, both academically but also in their personal skills and their business skills. And so my hope would be that every student graduating from Willamette High School would earn a SIN, because no matter what they did, whether it be college or whether they go on to work at Jerry's or Walmart or any other place, that they are smarter than they would have been before. And I think our society needs that.
Either or both of you gentlemen can answer this one. I can tell you, over a period of time, I've heard from a lot of people who would like to see the SIN CAM eliminated. I've heard from a lot of other people who think we need to modify it, whether it's because of cost or the principle or the philosophy of the standards-based education. Do you have any comments? I know, obviously, that you would not want to abolish SIN CAM. You've said that. What are your views about modifying, and if you have some developed, what would you suggest?
A couple of the things that I would comment upon: the recent actions by the State Board to tie parts of the Certificate of Advanced Mastery to the high school diploma, I think, are a step in the right direction. Even if students don't earn a CAM, it will help their experience by completing those particular parts of it. And secondly, I'm worried about what seems to be the increasing complexity of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, with almost every curriculum area in the high school having a piece of the CIM. Mm-hmm. So some simplification there might make it more understandable for folks, and with understanding would come, I believe, a better buy-in.
I like the idea of the CIM, the spirit of the law of the 21st Century Schools Act. It's a good spirit. And I think it is in the same direction. But I think the minutiae of the law is where we got bogged down into some problem areas. I would like to see a direct link between graduation from high school and a CIM. Not a delinking where someone can opt out of the CIM and continue to graduate, and society in general sees no difference. If we are going to have it, let's give it some meat. Let's put something behind the term, the Certification of Initial Mastery. Right now, with the two options, remembering how I was very unsuccessful in high school myself, I would have opted to continue with the easiest course. It was my nature at the time. Regrets would follow many years later. But again, I think that as long as we have that option, it's never going to have the power that was intended for it.
There are those who say, now looking ahead to the No Child Left Behind Act, that we should perhaps align our SIM requirements to the No Child Left Behind Act, which would feature, I guess, English, mathematics, and science. And then there are those who want to make the rest of the current SIM requirements optional by school district, perhaps, or maybe by student even. Comments on that?
From a principal's personal point of view, I think that would be a positive direction to look at. As I said, the increasing complexity of rolling in of SIM standards, and then with No Child Left Behind coming also at what schools and kids are required to do, I'm worried about being asked, kids and parents and schools being asked to do more things than they're able to do.
Mm-hmm. Representative,
follow up to that?
Yes.
If you were to limit it in that respect, how would you accommodate the, the advanced learning in music and the arts or physical education or literature, so that those students had something to strive for as well?
In the years we've been emphasizing the SIM, we've had no diminution of enrollment or performance in the arts or the other curriculum areas that you mentioned, Representative. Those are often the things which bring joy to kids' lives, and they've maintained themselves very strongly in our particular school. And it's often then the 11th and 12th grade Certificate of Advanced Mastery programs that allow kids to do the focus and specialization in the arts and those other particular areas.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, yes, Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might follow the same line of reasoning. My understanding of the No Child Left Behind law is that it requires states to have standards, not that it tells them what those standards should be. Are you suggesting that we modify SIM in light of the No Child Left Behind law, or scrap it and start over?
I think the system that's in place, the SIM, CAM, are a good direction for Oregon kids in schools. And I think that simplifying the standards so that we have a more clear focus in the 9th and 10th grade for kids would be a direction that I would recommend.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Principal Jameson, I was just looking at this program where the SIM award recipients are listed here. Yes. And I was just wondering what the sort of percentage was of eligible for the SIM, received the SIM at Willamette High School.
In this last year. I believe, I have that on a sheet of paper, I think it's in my briefcase, Representative. We began with about 20% of the sophomore class earning a SIM the first year. And this represents about one-third of the class after 4 years. But we believe we're making steady progress to, we'd like to see 85 to 90% eventually.
It's pretty low.
It is.
Thank you.
And if I may offer one word,
sure.
Statement, please.
Sure.
We believe that as kids have progressed through the system in first grade, that there would be an increase in the number of kids, because this represents kids who have only been in what I'm going to call a standard system for Oregon schools for a few years. But as kids go from first grade, we believe there'll be a big difference.
Mr. Chair, my fault.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Principal Jameson, how many folks do you have, how many instructors, teachers, or other personnel do you have at your high school that work directly with the SIM program?
Every teacher does, through either teaching classes or working as a portfolio manager, and every licensed staff member is a portfolio manager for 10 or 11 ninth and 10th graders. Mr. Saunders was as well.
May I also add to that, that includes every administrator, every counselor in the building. If you're an adult, you could be a portfolio manager. And what that does is it gives us our opportunity to save for the kids their best work. They can change it out as work progresses over time, but every adult is involved in it.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And how much time would you say they spend per day, part of their work day, on focusing on sort of SIM, managing the SIM program?
Well, in terms of managing, perhaps not so much. The portfolio groups with the managers meet every 5 or 6 weeks for 15 or 20 minutes. There are other times during the year where we do some, I'll say, collation and collection of student work to prepare for those meetings. In terms of teacher time, English teachers spend much more time on it than a PE teacher does, because the English teachers do their regular classroom work and the writing and the reading that goes into that.
Mr. Chair,
follow up?
Yeah. So I think what I hear you saying is that we have a SIM, we have a program that produces, at least at this early point, relatively a small percentage of students who are eligible to receive their SIM actually receive their SIM. Yet the majority of the folks within your high school are involved in, I guess, the administration of the SIM program, and you have teachers, in particular English teachers, that spend a great deal of their time preparing students for the SIM who may ultimately not receive a SIM.
That's correct, and I perhaps erred in not making this clear, and I apologize. As teachers work with students on writing assignments that will help a student earn a SIM, those writing assignments also are for grades toward a diploma and for college admission and for a variety of other tasks as well.
Mr. Chair, I'll remind you of two essays that I showed you, 11th grade students that were SIM essays from a high school here in the area, and I just would like to make the observation that they pass the SIM, whatever the passing grade is, but certainly I think they would have difficulty attaching cover letters to resumes to get jobs. So I have some concerns about the way the SIM operates.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. I'll follow through with that just a little bit, Representative Dalto. My son actually graduated from Willamette High School. He operated a 4-point-plus student. He scored 1,400 on his SATs and is now on the dean's list at Lewis and Clark College, and he did not receive a SIM. So it's interesting that some of the brightest don't, yet your observation that some folks who perhaps are receiving it, and it's not really a demonstration of any high level of proficiency. You know, there is all kind of intertwined. And I think Mr. Jameson's comments regarding simplifying the program, I don't think you mean making it easier. I think you mean making it easier to administer. Am I correct? I'll also note that through the years, I hired many, many dozens of your students, and I've always been very pleased with the job that they did for me. So things are working. Thank you.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as a summary, could either or both of you describe the difference between what a diploma measures and what a SIM measures?
A diploma states that a student at least can perform at a 60 percentile. Would you hire anyone that performs at a 60 percentile? A SIM states that an individual has scored a minimal on an examination showing proficiency in certain areas of subjects. It is not based on the D level. It's a little higher than that. We look at mastery usually at an 80%. And that is what our goal is as educators in our building, a minimal approach of 80% and higher than that. If we can get, and the progression of just the percentages of students who have moved towards the SIM, if we can get 80% of our students to meet this standard in testing, then all of us would be very, very happy. But as long as you have an option out of the program and can achieve the same results with half the work, a lot of students, myself included, would have gone the easier route.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you journeying up from Eugene and testifying for us. Very interesting. Clark Brody is next to sign up, or to be invited, I guess we should say, too.
Good afternoon, Representative Backlund and members of the committee. I'm Clark Brody, for your records. I'm primarily a retired career administrator and former deputy of the Department of Education. Some of my responsibilities were working directly with the state board regarding their work regarding the SIM and the CAMP. So that's the perspective that I bring to you. This afternoon, what I thought I would do would be to take a couple of minutes and talk about a framework for looking at our education system in Oregon, then show the relationship of the Certificate of Initial Mastery to our education system, and then show the relationship of the Certificate of Advanced Mastery to the system, as well as the diploma, and then pretty much open it up for dialogue and questions. And I think maybe that context will answer some of the questions that you had for the previous presenters. So you're going from an individual scenario, school environment, two individual school environments. And I'm going to take you up higher now to start with, and then we can drop down into the details. And I hope that will reveal how this is a fabric that's woven together, and the underpinnings of both certificates are critical to our education system and the success of each student. I distributed a handout to you that looks a bit, mine has my notes on it like this, with some of my talking points on it that you may, I'm going to pretty much try to just keep, be pretty tight in my comments as I work through. The department, about a year ago, developed a document called the Cornerstones for Student Success and Oregon's Evolving Education System, Pre-K through High School. And I took these excerpts from that document, and I'll try to just focus on the critical points. The first cornerstone is really that our education system is designed and should strive to provide personalized, active, and meaningful learning for each student. I would suggest to you that that doesn't occur in some levels of our education nearly as much as it should. Personalized means that we know every student. We know who they are, what their strengths and weaknesses are, what their personal interests are. Active means that they're actively engaged in their own learning. They're not sitting passively in a classroom and just doing an assignment. They're actively participating in the pursuit of their learning. They can co-design the direction that their learning takes. And ultimately, then, that results in greater meaning for the student, greater interest on the part of the student, greater motivation on the part of the student. So personalized, active, and meaningful learning is a critical component to our education system. I will just suggest to you, in a traditional high school, I was a high school principal for 4 years. When I first got there, my teachers were seeing about 180 to 190 students a day in 7 periods. I would suggest to you that is not what I mean by personalized, active, and meaningful learning. So we have a long ways to go here, but I want to emphasize how important that is to student success. If you talk to kids and have them come in here, they'll cite to you an individual teacher who got to know them, who related to them, who made their learning in that class or in that subject area personalized, and they were actively engaged in it, and it became more meaningful, and that's why they cite back to that relationship. The second cornerstone has to do with high academic expectations. These are the standards that Oregon has established. They're represented by our standards. Our standards are very high in the state of Oregon. They are truly challenging standards. The standards are in 7 different areas. Math, science, social science, English, and then we have arts, PE, and second language. 4 of those are scheduled to be on a timeline to be state assessed, and 3 are assessed by local school districts. Now, what the high expectations and the standards represent is what we hold common for each student that's in our education system. The first cornerstone, the personalized, active, and meaningful learning, is what we all bring as learners that's unique. That's unique to our education system. Just like each member of the committee brings a different context to the committee's work, there are still things that you all have in common that you hold yourselves to. And that's true of our education system also. And an important piece, the standards also are a guide for instruction. They have, when I first started teaching, we didn't have standards. And it was pretty much follow the textbook. That ended up being your guide. And now we do have standards, we do have a guide, and it plays a very important role. Now, the other interesting thing that people, many people don't understand about the standards movement is that it was unfolded to answer some very specific questions. Who's learning? Who's not? And why? And that evolved around the issues of equity, who's learning and who isn't, and what we learned when we started looking at students' performance across the standards, we found out that there are certain groups of our kids who are absolutely not learning. And then we turn around and ask the question, why? Now, this is nationwide. This just isn't Oregon. However, Oregon has been one of the leaders in this. And when we ask the question, why, that gets at the issue of access. We found out that many of our students don't have access to the higher level coursework that will allow them to be successful and meet our standards. So the underpinnings across standards and holding high academic expectations really simply are driving at the question of who's learning, who's not, and why. The third cornerstone is learning for understand and application. Understanding and application go hand in hand. We need to give our youngsters the ability to apply what they know and can do. Every time we apply what we know and can do to a new context, to a problem, to a situation, to making a decision, we deepen our understanding of what we learned before. The more we apply to new contexts, the greater and deeper our understanding is, and the better we get. We used to call it the transfer of learning. And the more we have the ability to transfer our learning to a new situation, a new context, the better we get at it. And so this is a very critical part of our education system, and one that we're striving to improve. And when I finish, I want to just mention a couple of decisions the State Board has made recently which will really help this and help our students. The fourth cornerstone is that learning occurs outside of the classroom or beyond the classroom. It's just not about what happens in the classroom. We have youngsters that are learning many, many things outside the classroom. They bring that personal context into the classroom. We should be giving them credit for what they know and can do already. Why would we have them sitting in a class when they already can do it? And the board recently passed an administrative rule that allows school districts to award credit based on proficiency. So the student in Portland who is first chair or in the Portland Youth Philharmonic and coming to a Portland high school doesn't have to sit in a fine arts class and to get that credit. The district could see if they're meeting the content standards based on their participation in the Portland Youth Philharmonic. Maybe they need to supply some evidence around some of the standards that isn't demonstrated through that vehicle, and the district could award that student credit. Then the student could spend that time pursuing their own personal interests and move to a higher level of academic performance or career exploration as it applies to their personal interests. It really opens up some tremendous opportunity. Furthermore, with technology, the schoolhouse, no longer, we don't have to come to the schoolhouse to gain access to information anymore. I was recently speaking in a George Fox class for educators, and five of the students in the class were presently teachers in the elementary school. I said, approximately how many of your students have internet access at home? And they all suggested to me around 75%. Now, I've traveled the state in different focus groups, and I think that's a little bit high statewide. But if they don't have it at home, they have it at the local library, or they have it at their church, or they have it someplace close by in the community. And quite frankly, we have not taken advantage of that ability in our education system as much as we need to and should. So learning occurs beyond the classroom, and we need to account for that. It's not just the textbook. It's not just the teacher. Now, this has tremendous implications for the role of the teacher as a broker of education opportunity to assure that students are meeting the learning outcomes of their course content, but they can learn it in a lot of different ways. The fifth cornerstone is that our education system is built on standards-based and student-centered teaching. What this cornerstone is talking about is how important the role of the teacher is. The single most important component to a successful education for a student is that we put an effective teacher in front of every student every minute of the day. That is singly the most critical piece to fostering student success. And so it's around the core value of teachers. This cornerstone is here to recognize that teachers make decisions every day that either lead and help students become more successful or don't, and that's why it's so important. Their role is so important. Now, that's a general framework around our education system and what we're trying to provide, how we want to see it unfold and what it provides for youngsters. So what's the relationship to that and the diploma? The state requirements for a diploma are 22 credits. So presently a student has to get a D grade or better to receive a diploma. Now, many school districts have added additional credits to that, and they've added requirements to that, but that's the minimum as required by the state, and their credits, of course, fall in different content areas. Now, the state board, a year ago in December, strengthened the diploma and required some of the components of the certificate of advanced mastery for the diploma. Students will build an education plan and build an education profile. The plan capturing the individual student interests, or cornerstone one, the personalized, active, and meaningful engagement around their learning, capturing their interests, and evolving career interests to connect them to their next steps. And so it's captured that in the education plan. The education profile is simply the documentation of what students have accomplished or achieved during their time in high school. And then it also emphasizes career-related knowledge and skills that students are going to need to be successful. Those diploma requirements will unfold for the class that graduates in the year of 2006-07. So what's the certificate of initial mastery? First of all, it's a certificate. It is not a program. Those seven areas where we have set standards, where the legislature has directed standards be set by the State Board and the Department of Education, every one of those areas were areas that were already part of our school curriculum. And so the certificate truly is a certificate. It is there to honor students who have met standards at its full implementation in those seven areas: math, English, science, social science, arts, PE, and second language. Now, that's unfolding, and those are all up in terms of the timeline and the rollout presently, but at its full implementation, that's what the Certificate of Initial Mastery will represent. Now, there's an underpinning here that is very important to understand. The accountability system in education for years has been seat time. We were accountable for seat time. But we now have ways to hold students accountable for something other than seat time, which is their level of proficiency. There's a major paradigm shift happening all across the United States. And I want to suggest that I didn't realize until I assumed my role at the department and traveled outside the state and interacted with other states, how Oregon is viewed by other states as a leader in this effort. But it's really a paradigm shift from measuring seat time and having to spend time in a seat in a desk. And now those rules are still on our books, 130 clock hours per credit for seat time, to proficiency. And with the most recent decision the State Board made, it now allows students and districts, rather schools and districts, if they choose — they're not required to, but if they choose — to award credit based on proficiency now. Now, this is going to have a very interesting effect as people grasp this and provide the professional development necessary for this to take place. It helps students who are active learners and aggressive learners, because I see no reason why students couldn't complete their associate's degree while they're still in high school. And some students have done that. They've done it at Powers High School, which is a small high school with a graduating class of around 17, and I've heard that this has happened out in Ontario. They've gotten their diploma one night and the next night gone over to Treasure Valley and received their associate's degree. Now, it's just not students who are active and very good learners. It also assists students who learn at a slower rate, who now, when they can't complete a semester course with a passing grade, what's the only option for them right now? They have to go back and repeat the entire course, and they're locked in again for the seat time requirement. And now, based on proficiency, now they can continue on and complete the remainder of the course, get the credit, even if it's in the middle of the semester. Now, this is districts may award credit based on proficiency. They don't have to do that. That's their choice. But this opens up some tremendous flexibility. The State Board recognizes that schools don't have the capacity they need right now, particularly in the challenging economic times, to be able to support students and districts in unfolding and supporting these changes. So they're trying to provide school districts and schools greater flexibility. What's the certificate of advanced mastery then? Remember, the first cornerstone represented who the student was and their personal interests, and the second cornerstone around high expectations were those things that we hold in common. SIM represents those things we hold in common. CAM represents those personal interests of the student. It's really to connect the student. The purpose of the Certificate of Initial Mastery was to assure that each and every student make a successful transition to their next steps, whether that's into the workforce directly, whether it's to the community college, whether it's to the four-year school, or whether the other option that is there often is the military. We have to capture who the student is, what their personal interests are, and connect the learning to those interests. We have, as educators, a responsibility to do that. Now, if you take a look at some of the national statistics about the success of students who go on to college, it's really pretty sad. Nationwide, in a book that I read recently, one-third of the students who enroll in a four-year school aren't even in that same school at the end of the first year. Now, it doesn't mean they have just totally dropped out, but they're no longer enrolled in the same school. They may have left that school and enrolled in the community college. They may have left for another institution. And the number one reason they give is they when they got there, they didn't see a reason of being there. Now, I know for many, the diploma's goal was this, and I having been a high school principal and done the hugs after the students walked the stage and intermingled with for the photo shoot, talk to kids and say, well, what are you going to do next? Well, you know, you have kids, a former student of mine who's Katie Harmon, a Miss America, and I know that's a name familiarity, and you know, she knew where she was going and she knew what she wanted to do. And then I could go on to the next student and say, well, you know, I'm really tired right now. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a couple months off and then I'll just sort of, just rudderless. Part of the purpose of the CAM is to capture who the student is, what their interests are, encourage the exploration, make more relevant their learning so that it makes sense to them. Jim pointed out that part of that purpose of the CAM is to connect their learning, their academic learning, with the real world, with the world that they know and live outside of school. Think of that fourth cornerstone. Learning occurs outside the classroom. We're trying to weave those together. So it's very important that the Certificate of Advanced Mastery says students have met high academic standards in four areas that are state assessed: math, English, science, and social science. And they've also demonstrated some knowledge and skills in the career-related learning. And they've also demonstrated through their work, through evidence of their work, that they can apply what they know and can do in an area that they're interested in. Now, every student carries a context to the learning environment. A teacher would never know how the student is interpreting the instruction unless the teacher interacts with them. And it's only upon that interaction can you see how the other person who received the communication interpreted it. So that's a good segue and a good transition for me now to stop here and allow the interaction to take place, and I'd be more than delighted to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, sir. Just a quick question for you, Mr. Brody. One of your points is that we need to who's learning, who's not learning, and why. Mm-hmm. In your analysis, how good of a job are we at identifying who is and who isn't learning at this point in time?
Well, I think what you, Mr. Chair and Representative Farr, I think what you're seeing is that's pretty much the impetus behind No Child Left Behind. Uh-huh. And I'm not an expert on No Child Left Behind. The Federal Department of Education has identified subgroups of students that have not demonstrated that they're learning well, and in fact learning very poorly. And some of those are learning disabled students, some of those are students of poverty, some of those are different ethnic groups of students. Our Hispanic population, our Oregon data runs fairly parallel with what they're finding on the national level. And so what that has revealed to us is that these students are learning. The other thing that we've learned is that when we look at what courses they've had access to, we're finding out that they don't have the same access to those courses. Once we know a student isn't learning, then it allows us to focus in a greater way on those students. Now, I want to submit to you, though, there is a danger on this, and we need to strike balance in our education system, because we are accountable to parents for their student. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if they're part of a group that's low performing or a group that's high performing. As a principal, when you're sitting across the table from a parent, it's their child that's the most important, and we have to be sure that we're serving each child.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dalton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Borden, do we have a sense of how SIM recipients are breaking down sort of demographically or even ethnically?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, we have the state assessment system now. There's an interesting... Obviously, the SIM is made up of assessments and students accomplishing, meeting the standards in the different areas that are required. Students can begin at their sophomore year, actually earlier now, but their sophomore year accomplishing or demonstrating that they've met those standards and can accumulate that and continue to take those until they graduate from high school. So there's a span of time which kids can accomplish those. If we look at our assessment data, we can tell pretty much who is meeting the standards and who isn't, and then deduct from that who then is going to be eligible to complete a SIM and who isn't. Now, presently at the state level, we don't have student-level data. All we have is school data. Now, the Department of Education has a very important policy option package that they have built in their budget around building an electronic web-based system that will provide student-level data to the schools. And this is a huge capacity builder for the schools and remove some of the record-keeping burden that you heard Mr. Jamieson allude to that every high school is wrestling with right now, because the department will be able to download their assessment data right down through the website, through different electronic means, right down to the student level. And students and their parents, with a PIN number and access to the web, will be able to pull up their students' assessment information and see if they're meeting the assessment. It's a great tool for creating the partnerships that we want to see between parents, school, potentially employer, if the student then would have a mentor. If I was a student and I was working, doing an internship, let's say at InFocus in Wilsonville, and I had a mentor with me and I wanted to show them my performance on the standard so they could coach me a little bit, I could log in with a PIN number. Now, we have a student identifier for every student in the state, but this policy option package, in order for us to unfold the vision of this, we just need to have the financial support on that policy option package. The other tremendous benefit around this is the connection to higher education, because then that electronically, every student's education profile, that's what they've achieved, can go directly to the institution that they might be pursuing to further their education, whether it be a community college or higher education. So that's a long answer, but the short answer is yes, we can deduct pretty much who's learning and who isn't from our assessment data.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I clarification, I guess, really. I was just asking, do we know if more males earn SIMs than females? Do more females earn SIMs than males? How are Hispanics faring? How are other minority groups faring? That was my question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, not so much in relationship to the certificate itself, but to the individual standards and assessments that make up the certificate, we can draw those conclusions from that data.
So nothing yet?
Not regarding the SIM. We only get school-level data regarding the SIM.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm.
Clark, you heard my question asked earlier of Jim and Bob regarding the controversy of maintaining the SIM cam or making it optional to school district or even eliminating it. What are your views on, say, modifying it along the lines that we discussed earlier?
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly think there is some value in making sure that No Child Left Behind is brought into alignment with Oregon's vision for its students and education. We're very lucky in our state because we have a vision for education in our state. A lot of states don't, and their default position, what we're seeing across the nation, is No Child Left Behind. Where you have no vision, you're going to default to the requirements that the feds place on you. The board is wrestling with, as evidenced by what you read in the media right now, with decisions to bring as much and bend No Child Left Behind, if you will, interpreted in a way that encourages and fosters Oregon's vision for education, are doing a good job of it. Mr. Jamieson made a good point, and we hear this all the time. It's very complex. I would suggest to the committee, it's also complex because we haven't provided schools and districts with additional capacity that they need to implement it successfully. And they've been making a yeoman's effort to do that with very little tools and resources. Simplifying it probably holds some benefit. But again, I would draw your attention back to the cornerstones. I believe very from the deepest part of my heart that these cornerstones are essential to educational success of our students. And as the committee is looking at ways to make adjustments that they feel are appropriate, I hope that the cornerstones will be something that you really hang on to be sure that the underpinnings are there for a successful education system.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Our next presenter will be Diane McKillop. Diane can introduce herself and where she's from and what she does.
Good afternoon, Chairman Backlund and members of the House Education Committee. My name is Diane McKillop. I'm a high school English teacher in Salem-Keizer Public Schools. Although I am a Salem-Keizer teacher, my views that I'm sharing with you today are my views. I wasn't elected by the district to come and share my views with you. So these are my views, but I do have quite a bit of experience, so I think they have some value. I have been an English teacher since my hair was black, and that was a long time ago. I did take 12 years off when my kids were young, and then returned to teaching in 1985, so I have a total of 18 years of teaching experience. Currently, I am the department coordinator for English and foreign languages. That's been my job for 5 years. I spent 3 years as the building SIM coordinator for English, and I worked very closely with math people in my building. But that position this year has been cut by the district. There was some funding because of budget problems. However, as the English department coordinator, the responsibilities that I had as the SIM coordinator, those responsibilities have not gone away. So, and I'm really feeling that pinch this year. I teach sophomores, not honors sophomores, but what we call untracked sophomores, the kids who aren't at the honors level. And I also teach college writing for high school students, and they earn high school and college credit. I want to talk to you what it was like from my perspective as a teacher before school reform. And I want you all for a minute to think back sitting in a high school English classroom and writing an essay. Okay, English teacher gives you a topic. For the most part, then you struggled with that topic. Maybe it was like, here's your topic, bleed on the paper. This is when it's due. So you turned your paper in, and then the teacher used red, or I use green, ink, and bled all over your paper. You got your paper back, and maybe you got a B minus. So you looked at the paper, you looked at all the writing on the paper, and it was like, okay, a B minus. I wonder what was in that English teacher's head. Students at that time arrived in English classes with a variety of experiences. It depended on the goals of the previous English teacher. I have always believed in the value of writing because my English teachers in high school did a really good job of teaching me how to write. And then, of course, I ended up being an English teacher based on that. When I had freshmen at that time, they wrote essays, several essays during the year. Then when they were sophomores, they would come back to visit me and say, oh, Mrs. McKillop, this year I don't have to write essays. And they, you know, felt very good about that. That was very frustrating as a teacher, but I continued teaching writing. My son, who attended the same high school, would watch me at home at night and say, "Mom, why don't you have one of those English jobs like who never assigns essays and never has to grade essays?" And I thought it was interesting that he was even paying attention to the fact that I was grading papers. And I said, "Well, John, I believe in the value of writing." However, since school reform, this picture has changed. Teachers, English teachers, are now required to teach writing as a process. Teachers teach students how to score their own writing and how their writing is scored. And if you would look at the scoring guides that I just passed out to you, and in essence, this is what is in an English teacher's head. We score for ideas and content, organization, voice, word choice, sentence fluency, and conventions. And if they're doing a research paper, we also score for citing sources. In order to pass a classroom work sample, students must earn fours in four of these areas. But if you would read the description of a four, I was listening to Representative Dalto's comments. A four is not a high standard. My students in college writing, once they're older, have to maintain fives and sixes. So in my classroom, students might earn fours and pass their classroom work sample, but that is a B minus C plus in class. So that's not a high standard. However, now students know if they're having problems in ideas and content, that is indicated on the score that they have. Now, they get scores for SIM, but they also get credit for classes. So this counts; these essays count as work that they do in my English class. So in math, we have the same scoring guides. We have some scoring guides, but the reading and literature, because of the problem with work samples, is not off the ground. However, we do use that information as we teach students. So with scoring guides, teachers know clearly what it is that students are supposed to be able to do when they write. We have a process. We have samples from the state where we can share different modes with students. We can share with students in ideas and content. This is three paper, and this is a four paper, so we can show them what it is we are asking them to do. I might note, if you were going to guess, where our students are having the most trouble. Conventions. Spelling, grammar, punctuation, capitalization, usage, and paragraphing. Teaching grammar has sort of out of style. And we see that as students come into high school, they do not have a very good knowledge of grammar, and it's hard to catch that up. So that's most of the students who do not meet the standard in classrooms, it's because of a problem with conventions. That makes me sad, but it's also helpful in that I know where their weak areas are. And I work on it, but we all work on it, but we still have a lot of work to do. Students at all levels are taught using the same language and the same standards as appropriate to their benchmark. The students in younger grades also have scoring guides, but written in a language that they can understand. Students are tested at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. And in addition, teachers require classroom work samples that demonstrate progress towards the standard. We say to students, you must be able to read, write, speak, and do math. They will say, well, SIM doesn't count for graduation. And I say, but the SIM is about reading, writing, speaking, and doing math. So that's part of graduation, and that's part of SIM. So it all works together, don't you see? I also give them extra credit if they pass their state tests, and also give them points for their rough drafts. We have all kinds of little things to try to ring them in, because it doesn't count for graduation. And we say, you must be able to demonstrate that you can do these tasks. When I became a department coordinator 5 years ago, I attended several summer in-services put on by the State Department. I was very impressed with their workshops. I met some outstanding writing teachers. Bonnie Hill is now working with the State Department. And if you attend a workshop with Bonnie Hill, what you learn about teaching writing, even when you've worked a lot on teaching writing, is quite outstanding. I was impressed with this knowledge I gained about teaching writing and reading, and how it aligned with the state standards. And I have used this knowledge to train people in my department and work with student teachers as they come into our building. Our student teachers, it depends on the program they're in the state, whether or not there's a support for what we're trying to do in the state in terms of SIM, and it's all over the board in terms of our colleges. When our students do have to do their work sample for the department, or for the teacher standards and practices, we work with them in the building to help them meet those standards. At McNary, we use results of state tests to place students in classes. Our eighth graders are not placed in honors English classes unless they've met the in English, unless they've met the benchmark in reading and writing. We are able to modify our curriculum based on the results. Students coming to us from middle schools know how to use scoring guides. They know the term mode. As applied to writing, that might be an expository mode, persuasive mode. They know what an acceptable essay must do. They are prepared, and the individuals I work with in math would agree. Now, are they all prepared? No. In a perfect world, they would all be prepared, but there's a number of reasons, and we know what many of these reasons are in education. They all aren't there. They aren't there because they don't come to school often enough. Their parents move around. They have language problems. They have learning problems. So I believe that across the state we have a clear understanding of the criteria based on good educational standards. And when we hear about No Child Left Behind, we're scared, because right now people come to Oregon to see what it is that we're doing because they're impressed with what we're doing. And what does No Child Left Behind mean? What about all of the work that we have done in terms of training teachers, in terms of training students, in terms of finally getting teachers used to the idea that thou shalt teach writing in an English classroom, and thou shalt produce work samples for students? And it appears that as we talk about eliminating SIM, the message is that if we back off and we move to nothing but multiple choice tests, that all of this isn't important and that we're going backwards. For example, I just had to fill out my order for state tests in reading. And because of No Child Left Behind, it used to be my ESL, English as a Second Language students in the building, didn't have to take the state test if they didn't. We have level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, level 5. And the 1s, 2s, and 3s were exempt from taking the test. But now students who have been here less than a year, because of No Child Left Behind, have to take the state reading test. That bothers me. It means someone is going to have to read that test to them. So with that little bit of experience, I feel a lot better about what Oregon has been doing, and I'm a little concerned about throwing out what we've been doing and totally following what the federal government might require. Federal requirements. How will we align? Who will do the aligning? What do we need to do to make this happen? Is the message out with the old and in with the new? We've put a lot of time, effort, and energy so far into, and we're not totally there yet to be where we are now. The concept of CAM is a good idea, but CAM keeps changing, and this is hard for us to put a finger on. CAM keeps changing, and we've developed some TAM core areas, but it's changed enough, and it's this whole changing nature of education that's so frustrating for teachers and as students. And as this changes, students say, see, it really doesn't matter, because it's not going to count, or tomorrow it's going to be different. Now, I won't tell you that everything is perfect. It's very difficult to be in a school where you are trying to manage an unfunded mandate. We're lacking in money for teacher training. It's a huge burden on local schools, especially now that the district had to back off with some of their funding to help for time to make it happen. It takes a lot of time to get students, or to get tests ready for students to take them. At McMary, when we test 550 sophomores in writing and math, we just finished, and then in the spring we're going to do add science and do reading and literature and math again. The results that we get are we do not receive them in a timely fashion, so it's hard to use them to make decisions. But I believe in education we need consistency, and we have made so much progress, and I worry about stopping the progress that we have made at this point and going under the mandate of the federal government.
Questions?
Yes, Representative Hobson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I have a question. I just want to tell you how wonderful her testimony was to get somebody. We keep hearing that we don't hear from people out in the field, or the people on the front line, so to speak, and you're about as front-line-ish as it gets. I guess I would have one question that's almost rhetorical, but I would appreciate your answer if I don't put you on the spot. Would it be fair to say that some teachers have had a hard time with this whole, what Clark called, the paradigm shift over the last years?
Yes, and as a department coordinator, I've struggled with that. I wish I could tell you that everything was perfect, Representative Hobson, but it's not. For example, grading essays is very time consuming. It's much easier to give students a multiple choice quiz and run it through a Scantron machine. So there are additional issues as far as the burden on English teachers and the time it takes to teach writing and the number of students in class, and again, our education is complex, far from perfect, but we've come a long ways, and we still have a long ways to go. May I say long? We still have a ways to go.
Representative Dalton.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Ms. McKillop, I just very much appreciated your testimony. It made me think back of my education, how I really was unable to write until I got to high school, and thanks to some very caring and supportive teachers, it made a big difference in my life, really. I wanted to ask you, may I ask where you teach in Salem, Kaiser?
At McMary High School.
You teach at McMary High School. I know you said that you taught college writing, but did you say you also taught untracked students?
Yes, sophomores.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Have you had circumstances where you have difficulty getting students to turn in their work, assignments, or homework, that sort of stuff?
Yes. That's, sometimes, believe it or not, that happens with students even in college writing. Yes.
Okay. You know, and the reason for my question is I have a very good friend who attended Willamette with me and is a teacher. She used to teach at McNair. I'm sure you know her. She now teaches at North Salem High School. And she tells me every day how she has to bribe her students to turn in homework, and I guess I wanted to know if that was the symptom of working with untracked kids, or, you know, I guess I can imagine the frustration it must be, you know, trying to get folks to participate and they don't. I'm not sure that was a question so much as an observation.
Yeah, yeah.
Just trying to get at that. Just to bribe her children with candy to get them to turn in homework.
Well, of course, I don't offer food, but they do have to graduate. I mean, the whole idea is that you earn enough credits to graduate, and English is required 3 years for graduation, 4 years to go to college. So, as English teachers, we do have that hammer over their heads. But there's a lot of creative work that goes into gaining students' attention and encouraging them to be successful. And
just a strange concept to me. I used to do my homework.
Well, I've attended some hearings in the past and have invited none of these legislators to spend the day or two at McNary and to give them a feel for what it's currently like with kids. Kids haven't changed that much, but they have a lot of distractions. They're working, paying for car insurance, paying for cars, and some of them fail to see the relevancy in education. Sometimes it's later. Their maturity happens at different times. We try to push that maturity along, but it's hard.
Yeah, we're pushing them towards STEM. Mm-hmm. That was a great transition. thank you, Mr. Chair.
Diane, in the course of kind of considering this whole subject matter area of SIMS and CAMS and portfolios, that sort of thing, and do you have any observations about what some of your fellow teachers might feel about the statewide assessments leading to a SIM? Are they perhaps opposed to it, or they support it, or can you generalize?
The opinions are varied. Mm-hmm. We have some frustrations with reading and literature tests, sometimes in the subjective nature of the questions, but we share those frustrations with the State Department. In the math area, sometimes they see a difference in the difficulty of the tests, and they have frustrations with that. I have teachers who are frustrated with, they're mainly frustrated because of all the essays they have to grade. But it's still my contention, whether Sim was here or not, they'd still be grading essays. So they aren't all 100% into it, but I hear from English teachers, and it is a quite a burden on English teachers more so than other areas. Because it was unfunded. I mean, I think if it had been funded, I think we could have made up for some of the problems.
Yes, Representative Bakken.
You've mentioned funding a couple times, and I'm curious about what areas you felt were not funded that should have been, and what difference that would have made.
As an English department coordinator, when it's time to test sophomores in writing, then I have to order the tests, and then when the tests arrive, sometimes they arrive a stack of 550 folders, alpha by last name, and all those students are in different teachers' classes. So I have to get the manuals distributed, I have to get the packets ready for students. It's very particular on they have to sign a form that says that these will be under lock and key. I have to teach them how to give the test, go over the manual with them. Then if students don't show up, and once they've spent three class periods, then I have to try to help them figure out a way that we can make up for students who aren't there, because in order to meet the standard on our state report card, we have to test a certain percentage of students. Some students refuse. So it's very intensive in terms of organizing and then collecting all the materials and getting them back and sending them back to the state. That is very time-consuming. When it takes extra time to do that, the district did allow, I had two periods out of an eight-period day focused on SIM issues. But now I don't have those periods, and I still have the responsibility. And then the other money would do a better job on training teachers. We do that in department meetings, but I think all school districts could use additional staff development time that would involve training. We'd like to do more to train teachers in other content areas so that they could be real comfortable using the scoring guide, so that they could also encourage students to use correct grammar. I mean, there's a number of things that we could do. And then the portfolio collection. We have collected portfolios or created portfolios at McNary. South Salem has used portfolios. Our other three high schools haven't used portfolios, but that portfolio idea was something that isn't mandated, so it was open to school interpretation, and we like the idea of having a portfolio of successful work samples, so if parents say, well, what do you mean my student didn't pass that? We have the unsuccessful in classrooms and the successful. But now it's hard to do because, again, that's taking a lot of time and filing all of those, so we're really feeling bogged down. So we're relying on an electronic system that doesn't always work, too. So, you know, money for the system that will allow us to keep track of all this. I mean, there's a whole list of funding issues. But, and I know this is a bad time to talk about that because there isn't money.
Before it gets away from me, colleagues, I wanted to talk a little bit about how far Diane and I go back together. Diane started teaching full-time again in 1985, and I was at McNary with her until 1998. And so I had her daughter in class, and I had her son in class. And one of the things that is very intriguing is I see Diane. I don't know if I even said this to her, but I'm going to say it now. My son took English class from Diane, and I think he was not a very good student in terms of behavior, and I used to agonize about that, and I used to wonder if I should talk to Diane and see if she would seek some help from my son's, in this case, me, the father, see if I could help shape him up a little bit, and she did not ask for that help, and so he graduated from high school, and when it comes time for getting some recommendations from high school teachers, he chose Diane. I was surprised, and I said, how come? Well, she was tough, and she had high standards, he said. I was always impressed with that. So that was my chance to say that, Diane, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Are you trying to tell us that Diane was not one of your students?
She was not one of my students. That's kind of a standard joke. Since I've hung around this area for a long time and taught at McNary High School for 33 years, I see many former students. And so I'm going to take that as a compliment that I never want to hang around that long and survive that long. And so it's been a real pleasure for me to be able to see former students. But Diane was not one of my former students.
Colleague.
Do we have anyone else who'd like to testify today? We had another person invited, and he's not here. Thank you very much, Diane. He's not here, and we have a little bit of time. So, is there anyone who'd like to? Yes, Kate.
Just coming back.
Oh.
I would like to add just 5 minutes of comment.
Please.
In context, if that would be helpful.
That'd be great.
It's hard to sit quietly the whole time.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Backlund, I'm Kate Dixon, and I live at 19745 Wildwood Drive, Westland, Oregon. And I'm here based on the fact that I've been an educator for the last 33 years and have recently retired from the Department of Education. So I've been around a long time, and I've been part of these conversations, and the only reason I'd like to say a couple of words today is not that I'm an expert on anything, but I have been in this business a long time, and quite frankly, the last 3 weeks were the first weeks that I haven't been involved in education matters, and it's a little on the strange side, but I must say it's also very nice. But I thought it might be helpful, since some of you are a little new to the conversation around school reform, and I think the context that I'd like to bring, and I hope this isn't a repeat of some information you've received at another time, but in there have been waves of school reform since the mid 1800s, and initially there was a wave of school reform that created high schools in the early 1900s, and then there was another wave of school reform, and quite frankly they created high schools in the early 1900s mostly to keep the children off the streets, and I think we've come a long way since those days. But we've also moved through major reform efforts in the 1930s and the 1940s. But not to take us back quite that far, I'd like to start in about 1957, and some of you may or may not remember that era, which was the Sputnik era. And there was a huge reform effort at that time around math and science, and it was driven both at the state level and at the federal level. And there was new programs, new math, for any of those of you that may have parents or if you experienced new math in your schools at the time. And that was just sort of the beginning of a wave of major school reform. 1965 came along, and that was the Elementary Secondary Education Act, which was the forerunner to No Child Left Behind, by the way. And again, that didn't just drop out of the sky. And it was an attempt to educate children of poverty and to assure that children of poverty were able to learn and be successful in school at the same level as other children. And it has evolved over the last number of 40-some years as well. But what it began to create is an expectation that children could read, write, and do mathematics at a high level. And so in 1965, that really began to drive much of what was going on in the schools. In 1975, about 10 years later, there was the effort around special education, and the Special Education Act was passed by the federal government. And so you had both what was called the Elementary Secondary Education Act and then the Special Education Act. And I think you know how that has also influenced education. Also in the 70s, there was a lot of school reform around teaching in open classrooms. And a lot of effort went into the notion that children needed a broader opportunity to explore and experience their learning. By 1980, that wave had kind of come and gone, and people were beginning a rallying cry for it's time to get back to the basics. And one reform that has really catapulted us into what we call the Oregon Education Act was a paper that was written in 1983 for the Reagan administration that was called A Nation at Risk. And I bring that forward so that as you struggle with what to do with the SIN and CAM, that you know that it isn't something that just came out of nowhere, that it really had a history, and the initial history for the SIN and CAM was the Nation at Risk report from 1983 that created a concern around a rising tide of mediocrity. And it really asked the question, how do we assure, again, that all children learned at high levels? And through the rest of the 80s, both Oregon and the federal government tried to create programs that would assist children, particularly in the areas of reading, math, and writing. And for some of you that have been around a long time, you may remember House Bill 2020, which was an Oregon school improvement set of legislation that was passed, I think, in about 85 or 86. And then there was a bill that passed, which was a grant money for schools to be 21st century schools. And then in the early 90s, finally, out of those two, the House Bill 2020, which was school improvement, and the 21st Century Schools Grant, came the legislation, the Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century, which created this phenomenon called the SIM and the CAM. And then there were 4 or 5 years of debate and consternation about what does the SIM mean, what does the CAM mean, and then in 1995, it was rewritten as House Bill 2991, and that is what we have continuing today. And I say this, and it struck me while I was listening to the testimony today that there are a variety of things that needs some improvement around the SIM and the CAM. Representative Dalto, you brought in some of those points about the inconsistency. Representative Farr talks about, well, you know, my son has a 1400 on an SAT but somehow didn't receive the SIM. There are those kinds of struggles around the implementation of the SIM. But what I also know, and I will piggyback on the testimony of Ms. McKillop, and that is that teachers and students across the state have put a tremendous amount of time and energy into this school reform. And as potentially imperfect as it is, there's been much effort to do the right thing, to be sure that our children are educated to higher standards. I, for one, am always a believer that there are better ways to do things. There are better mousetraps to be invented, and there's certainly probably a continuing way to look at how we create higher standards for our children, and how do we create that in a way that it personalizes their education and engages them in their work and activity. And I think my plea here today is that as you look at making better what we currently have, that we don't continue to send a confusing message to the field of education that says what we've been doing or what the field has been doing for the last 10 or 15 years has not been worthy. Because we do have a record of a decade of progress of our students in their education. The Department of Education probably can bring forward that data. But Oregon can be very proud of the overall results of their reform effort. Our students are achieving at higher levels today in Oregon across the board than ever before. The question, however, is how do we assure that for each student? And I believe that's where our challenge is at this time. But I also know that as we strive to do that, we need to build on what is good from the reform efforts of the past and make sure that we don't say, well, let's abolish this before we have something better to put in its place. Because a vacuum, I can assure you, will not do a better job of educating our children than what we currently have. So I think the real challenge is to assure that you have something that's better than what we currently have. And I have no doubt that you can do that. So I thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
It's been a most interesting afternoon. I can't think of too many more things I'd rather be doing than hearing these particular educational issues, and we look forward to more. So with that, we'll adjourn the meeting.